Alright, the time is 1 minute in the hour of 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. A very, very good morning to you all, the Eagle FM listeners, no matter where you are tuning in from. We appreciate you. Thank you so much for always choosing us. And of course, this is Early Morning Scoop, a program dedicated to providing you with latest updates on the economic entrepreneurship, public policy, that what we give you all here. And of course, I'm your host, Loisa Shimi, and I'll be with you until the hour of 7:30, just to bring you the usual update that is now the economic entrepreneurship, and of course public policy and trade updates, that what I'm going to give you there. But before I get to that, please do not forget to connect yourself with us on our social media platforms, Eagle FM Namibia on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, as well as the Village News web page on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And plus, do not forget to subscribe to our WhatsApp channel on the daily news update, and of course, newspaper alerts. And that's now Eagle FM Media House channel. Please do not forget to subscribe to our channel on the WhatsApp. Now, also, do not forget to download our app, Eagle FM app, on available on your Google Play Store and of course your App Store, and you just have to or rather just stay informed wherever you are. Now, to start off internationally, is that the activists in South Africa have raised alarm over the displacement of local communities due to the coal mining operations, the ongoing struggle for land, burial sites, and heritage is just one of the costs for the country's energy demands. Now, as communities are sacrificed for economic growth and energy production, we might take a listen to this.
Been described as South Africa's paradox. On the one hand, it is the source of the country's energy system, but on the other, it has also been central to the disposition of African communities. People's lives are continuously sacrificed to keep the energy system and the economy going.
Now, mining companies, when they see the land, they see a storage. Whereas for communities, they see beyond the material thing. They've got spiritual connections to the land. So mining companies are relocating people, their homes, as well as their ancestral graves, and moving these, for example, from private land to public spaces. And these are spiritual implications.
In her book titled No Last Place to Rest, Coal Mining and Dispossession in South Africa, Skhosana assesses that dispossession of land has been associated with a period of colonialism and apartheid. But in democratic South Africa, some communities still find themselves robbed of their land, burial sites, and heritage. Some activists say the careless relocation of people and their departed loved ones shows that dehumanization persists even in death.
It shows abantu abamnyama struggles, black people struggle when they're alive and even when they're dead. And it's a continuous struggle that doesn't end, because even though we have foregone apartheid and colonialism, we haven't addressed questions around dignity, what it means uba umuntu omnyama being respected as such, as a citizen.
This woman's home was destroyed to make way for a mining development. Her mother's, father's, and younger sister's graves were also forcibly moved.
It's hard for us. We live in constant fear. Those who spoke out have lost their lives. I've lost my home. My family's graves were moved, and now I have no idea where to go and mourn them. I still come back here, to this very same place where they were originally laid to rest, because it's the only connection I have left. Sometimes I wonder, what have we done to deserve this? Why is there no one to protect us? And more importantly, what can we do to make sure that other families do not have to endure this kind of pain?
A number of organizations have been fighting the mine owners in court for years to halt the relocations of communities.
They often do not have money, they don't have access to attorneys and all of that. So that process then drags longer. And mining companies know that communities are disadvantaged, then they can do whatever that they please. And communities are also financially disadvantaged. So sometimes they would be given monies just so that they shut up, they keep quiet, they don't speak to the media, and they don't expose all of these abuses.
In her book, Skhosana argues that the act of dispossession of both the living and the dead from their land wounds the collective soul of a people, eroding their cultural heritage, collective...
All right, there you have it. Now moving on to China. China continues to dominate the global garlic market, strengthening its position as the world top producer and exporter of this culinary staple. Now these vast farms are stretching across provinces like Shandong and Henan. Chinese farmers harvest millions of tons each year, feeding global demand.
If you have ever cooked with garlic, chances are it came from China. The country has long been the undisputed king of garlic production, supplying over 70% of the world's garlic.
Henan province is often referred to as the breadbasket of China, but it's also the garlic capital of the world. And there is a very good chance that the garlic in your kitchen, whether you're in Nairobi, Kampala, Paris or New York, its journey started right here.
China has a long history of garlic. It's over 2,000 years old. What's more, the Central Plains area is located in the middle and lower reaches of the Yellow River. The soil is more fertile, the garlic grown tastes better, and the quality is also good.
But China's dominance isn't just about quantity, it's about efficiency. Advanced farming techniques and large-scale processing allow China to export garlic at competitive prices, making it a key player in international markets.
We are trying to help the farmers to adapt to new technologies such as machines to save the labor input.
Mechanized agriculture has boosted garlic yields by 30% as opposed to traditional farming, which gave us approximately 10% of the garlic yields.
Many farmers are now leveraging live streaming platforms like Taobao Live to sell directly to consumers worldwide, cutting out middlemen and boosting profits.
We want to help farmers to connect directly with the customers so that they are able to make more money.
While other countries grow garlic, none come close to China's output. And with demand only growing, it seems that this is one title China won't be giving up anytime soon. For now, the world's garlic supply remains firmly in China's hands.
All right, there you have it, listeners. Now, to move on to the next item, we can listen to the discussion over the G20 agriculture working group. We might listen to this.
As to discuss the start of the G20 Agriculture Working Group meeting in Durban is Simone Engelbracht. She's Trade and Relations Officer at AgriSA. Good evening, Simone. Thank you very much for joining us on the program. So, of course, this leg of the G20 meeting comes against the backdrop of ongoing geopolitical tensions. As we know, global trade is facing serious headwinds, which many would say speaks to the need to crystallize the priorities at the G20 Working Group to respond to the current climate. We heard, of course, that some of the priorities include the promotion of policies and investments that drive inclusive market participation towards improved food and nutrition security. Your views on just this priority?
Good evening, Mufindu, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here with you tonight. Very rightly so, we echo the words of Minister Steenhuisen that we also believe that South Africa has a very relevant and constructive role to play in its current role as the G20 chair this year. And with regards to your point to policies and investments for inclusive smart areas as a key G20 theme, we really want to emphasize that agriculture requires investment and investment from climate to land rights, market access, women involvement, specifically with regards to the trade policies you mentioned. You know, markets lie at the heart of development, and so well-functioning markets are critical to improve livelihoods.
Mm-hmm.
So the core goal is the improvement in global food security.
Mm. Now, you touch on women. That is another priority, just the empowering of youth and women in agri-food systems. But just take us through your views on how this can be realized to ensure that they're empowered in this specific sector.
Thank you, Mufindo. Yes, so gender disparities and youth involvement remain a major issue across all nations. And we do see and hope that it would continue, that the G20 really shines a light on this, nudging countries, you know, to make an improvement on this. And for us, it is critical to activate the youth to be involved in agriculture for the future.
Mm-hmm. Now, we understand that AGOA will not form part of the discussions at this meeting purely because not all the countries attending are beneficiaries under that specific trade agreement. But the minister did touch in the briefing on at least their intention to present or to put together some sort of a proposal before the United States around these tariffs. Just your take on what some sort of a proposal or deal that our government should put forward to the United States should look like.
Yes, thank you, Mfundo. So I would not go into technical details since the discussions are still ongoing at this moment pertaining to specifically, you know, the AGOA and trade-related matters. But what I can say is that, you know, global trade is essential for all countries, and we need a collaborative approach for all to win, and with the end goal of achieving food security for all, as I've mentioned earlier. So I would leave it at that in terms of, you know, specific trade agreements for now, but happy to share more once these discussions have been concluded.
Mm-hmm. But they seem to be more positive that if anything, they'll try to fight the 30% tariff that, of course, now is held in abeyance for the next 90 days for countries to negotiate. They're saying at worst, they're hoping to ensure that we keep the 10% baseline. Would that work for your sector?
Yes, and I do think that, you know, what's also critical for South Africa is to, you know, to also diversify our thinking towards other opportunity or low-hanging fruits that exist as markets in the globe. So, yes-ish for now.
Mm-hmm. Simone, I love that you already touched about the need or on the need to diversify, because government is said to be exploring alternative markets for your agricultural exports to counter that impact of those tariffs. Many have said that this, in as much as it's a very volatile time, but also there are great opportunities here to explore those alternative markets. But when we look at government, it's essentially a facilitator, but you are essentially industry that would inform them of the alternatives that exist. Have you started to identify the alternative markets for your sector?
Thank you, Mfundo. Yes, we do work very closely with the government and industry stakeholders across the agriculture value chain to ensure that agriculture is profitable and sustainable. And so with regards to your question in terms of alternative markets, yes, the Southeast Asian area or the network of nations is quite critical for South Africa, you know, to consider as markets, whether it be, you know, to broaden the already existing market access or to gain market access for some African products not yet present in these countries.
All right, there you have it. Now to move on to the next item is that the intensifying downside risk dominant the outlook for the world economic advance, escalating trade tensions and financial market adjustment. That's the message from the International Monetary Fund in its latest world economic outlook, where it warns the divergence and supplying changing policy position or the deteriorating also sentiments could lead to even tighter global financial conditions. Now, as a result of escalating trade tensions, most notable between the United States and China, global growth is projected to drop to 2.8% in 2025 and 3% in 2026, now down from earlier projections of 3.3% for both years.
After weeks of market uncertainty and rising trade tensions between the world's two largest economies, the IMF now warning of the negative consequences, including the unpredictability with which these measures have been unfolding.
The surge in policy uncertainty is a major driver of the economic outlook. If sustained, the increase in trade tensions and uncertainty will slow global growth significantly. Reflecting this complexity, our report presents a reference forecast which incorporates policy announcements up to April 4 by the U.S. and trading partners. Under these reference forecasts, global growth will reach 2.8% this year and 3% next year, a cumulative downgrade of about 0.8 percentage point relative to our January 2025 WEO update.
The global lender also projects growth in South Africa at just 1% for this year, a slip from 1.5% the fund projected in January. While projections for 2026 now come in at 1.3% growth, down from 1.6% earlier this year. For sub-Saharan Africa, growth is expected to dip from 4% in 2024 to about 3.8% this year, recovering to 4.2% in 2026. As global pressures weigh on domestic impediments that have seen middle-income countries stuck in a low growth trap.
It needs a clear, stable, and predictable trading environment, one that addresses some of the long-standing gaps in international trading rules. Monetary policy will need to remain agile and respond by tightening where inflation pressures re-emerge while easing where weak demand dominates. Monetary policy credibility will be key, especially where inflation expectations might de-anchor, and central bank independence remains a cornerstone. The cost of living crisis, a surge in inflation rates to double digits that we haven't seen in more than a generation. So the critical thing is to make sure that inflation expectations remain anchored, that everyone remains convinced that central banks will do what is necessary to bring inflation back to central bank targets in an orderly manner.
Some positive sentiment. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is reported to have told a closed-door event Tuesday that the current U.S.-China trade war was unsustainable and that he expected a de-escalation in the near future as the White House continued to strike a positive tone.
President about this before coming out here, and he wanted me to share with all of you that we're doing very well in respect to a potential trade deal with China. As I mentioned, there have now been 18 proposals in more than 100 countries around the world who are wanting to make a deal with the United States of America, and the president and the administration are setting the stage for a deal with China. So we feel everyone involved wants to see a trade deal happen, and the ball is moving in the right direction.
Right, there you have it. The time is 19 minutes in the hour, 6 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. Now, to move on to the next item, is that as compared to the rest of the world, there is a risk or higher risk on the African continent of people suffering from preventable diseases due to limited access to health care. Now, Africa Vaccination Week aims to raise awareness to this issue by highlighting the importance of vaccinations in preventing diseases and promoting health. We might take a listen to this particular update.
For more on this conversation. Good evening, Doctor. Thank you very much for joining us on the late edition. Just talk us through, firstly, the significance of Africa Vaccination Week for the benefit of those who might not be aware.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having me. So the African Vaccination Week runs from the 24th of April until the 30th of April. It's a very important week that we need to celebrate and also pay more information to the public, is because mainly in South Africa, we are suffering from a whole host of diseases. And as you know, vaccinations have actually helped us beat these diseases, from measles, polio, as well as smallpox. The statistics actually show that about 154 million people have been saved from deadly diseases globally for the past 50 years as a result of vaccinations. So it really just shows how important it is to close the socioeconomic gaps that we do have in South Africa as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the theme this year is immunization for all is humanly possible. It's essentially self-explanatory, but can you expand on just the importance of this theme in achieving the targeted four goals?
Yes, so what it's all about is really pointing back to healthcare and how important it is. We have forgotten that healthcare is actually a human right, and a lot of people don't get this basic need. I work in a government hospital and clinic, and I see it every single day because we don't have enough resources sometimes, and at the same time, we also have a shortage of staff. So it's really important that the government as well as the private sector can somehow marry and work together so that we can actually go into the really destitute areas of South Africa, you know, the rural areas, the townships, where there's so many people that are suffering from a lot of comorbidities. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important that we really do expand on this week, because a lot of people aren't aware that they can actually get certain vaccinations at the clinic or mm-hmm. the hospital. A very important one is the flu vaccination, for example.
Yeah, I'm glad that you also touch on awareness there, that some might not necessarily be aware, because Doctor, there has been progress, but challenges persist in reaching children on the African region. So my question is really essentially, is it a resources issue or an awareness issue, or perhaps even both?
To be fair, it's actually both. I've worked in both the public and the private sector, and I can definitely say that a lot of patients do struggle to get to the clinics when it's necessary. A lot of our population actually is dependent on the government. About 84% of our population does not have medical aid. And these are the very same people that walk to clinics. These are the very same people that use taxis. And a lot of the times, they just don't have the money to get to the healthcare facilities. And on top of that, when they do get to the healthcare facilities, there's long lines, long queues, and a lot of them are told to come back the next day. And as a result of this, we really do lose a lot of critical patients in these under-resourced situations. In the same breath, there are quite a lot of, I would say, taboos or myths that some patients do come with about vaccinations or any other medical procedures. And I think that I do get quite a lot of questions from patients about what we're putting in their bodies. And I'm really happy that they asked me these questions, because it just shows that people want to know what's going on. And I think that after the COVID vaccine, people are more aware that there are some side effects with some of the medications, and it's important that we do talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Now that you touch on COVID, how much of an impact did it have on the program to increase immunization? Because most of the focus had been shifted to that pandemic, where it seems that other programs really were lagging behind.
Yes, so it's odd that the COVID vaccine actually showed a lot of issues that we have in our healthcare system. A lot of information wasn't relayed to the public in a more concise way. And I think that a lot of people were getting a lot of information from social media. So Facebook, WhatsApp messages, I was getting so many messages from even my mother sending me misinformation. And I think that it really points to the fact that we need to hone in on the people that are going to be explaining things and educating the masses, because at the end of the day, it does need to be somebody that's knowledgeable on the topic. And in the same breath, because of COVID, there were a lot of backlogs with other immunizations because of the fact that people couldn't go to the clinics. We were still isolating at the time. And I think that it also caused quite a lot of vaccine hesitancy, because quite a lot of people did experience some side effects. And as a result, people are now a lot more scared to actually get vaccinations.
All right, there you have it. Now, to move on, we can listen to the insights on the ECOWAS on this, or rather on the effort to convince Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger to rejoin BRICS.
Well, then I'm now joined by Basil Abia, a policy analyst and co-founder of Verif Africa, a Pan-African data insights company. He's joining us via Zoom from Abuja in Nigeria. Thank you very much for joining us on the program, Basil. So what impact will this AES levy have on trade between ECOWAS countries and those in the new Alliance of Sahel States grouping? And what does it mean for exports from ECOWAS countries?
Thank you very much. The immediate impact will be felt summary, and we have to look at the data first and foremost to understand what this means. As you know, intra-regional trade within ECOWAS member states, is about 12% of the entire trade volumes of ECOWAS member states. So If you're doing a valuation of about $30 to $35 billion, which are the estimates from the African Development Bank, you have to understand what this means when you have additional levies of 0.5% or more. Now, you also have to put into context that 60% of the intra-regional trade is actually carried out by small retail traders. So your usual provision store owners on the border towns in GBA between Nigeria and Niger, or the border towns, you know, for instance, between the Nigerian border and that of Benin. And that's the same for the borders between Mali and Burkina Faso and Ghana, or Mali and other countries in the region. So if 60% of your intra-regional trade is actually borne by these small retail traders, an initial bump in these levies basically means that there will be an increase in hidden taxes, what we like to call as hidden taxes, and the consumers are going to feel it. So a vast majority of consumers from across board are going to feel the immediate impact in this increase. We also have an erosion of the gains made by the common external tariff regime that ECOWAS has been holding since its 2000 protocol that was held in 2000. And up till now, it has definitely deepened intra-regional trade with ECOWAS. We still have issues, obviously, in that regard, but this erodes those progress. And additionally, there's a recessionary threat. The recessionary threat, you have to understand, of course, mind you, that countries like Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger are under the common currency network of the SEPA. And so that's a major reason why these countries have not really been enduring inflationary trends that countries like Ghana and Nigeria have endured in the last 2 to 3 years. So that monetary stability is what the SEPA, West African SEPA currency complex, provides these countries. But when you include these levies, right, there's a recessionary threat, right? And that can bump inflationary prices up. And if that bump happens, then with the projections of Burkina Faso and Mali having to see GDP growth rates at just 2% for 2025, it'd probably be even lower when the outcomes of these levies from the AES puts into place. So it's going to be really distortionary to price outcomes.
So let's look at that distortion a little bit further. Do you think, though, ECOWAS will respond to the AES move in similar measure, considering the conciliatory tone, including continued free movement for AES nationals and goods, is adopted in January when the AES states left?
I don't think so. And again, immediate history or recent history is my guide. As you know, for instance, Nigeria countered Niger's decision, obviously, to follow for the further double downing of the military regime. So when the military regime led by Chiani took over, Nigeria's first policy pronouncement was basically to counter that and put more pressure on the Nigerian junta. And what they did was to stop electricity supply from the Kainji Dam. As you know, we have this mutual agreement that for us to dam the lower Niger, which is in present-day Niger State in Nigeria, we would have to sell at very low rates, sell electricity to Niger. We also sell electricity to neighboring Benin Republic, by the way. And what we currently sell is about 360 megawatts. So Niger takes roughly 70% of that number. So over 250 megawatts actually of electricity is sold from Nigeria to Niger. And one of the punitive measures that we took was to end that. And when we ended it, we know how that was read in Niamey. They were furious, and they countered, and it actually soiled
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook,
Instagram and LinkedIn.
All right, the time is 31 minutes in the of 6 o'clock, and this is early morning skip. I just do have one last update on from the international side, and of course we can go into through the
consumer inflation decrease.
Now, to start or whether to add on the last update of the from the international side of it is that South Africa's consumer inflation has slowed sharply in March. South Africa data shows that annual consumer price inflation eased to 2.7% in March on year-on-year basis and down from 3.2% in February. Now, the main positive contributors to the annual inflation rate were housing and utilities and food and non-alcoholic beverages and, of course, restaurants as well as the accommodation services. So we're taking a listen to this update.
Eased for the first time in 5 months to 2.7% in March, also representing the lowest level in almost 5 years. The consumer inflation rate is below the midpoint of the Reserve Bank's target range of 3 to 6%. Food inflation recorded a low 2.2%. Higher price changes were recorded for the fruit and nuts, hot beverages and meat categories. Stats SA's Patrick Kelly says lower fuel prices partly supported the lower inflation. Petrol prices went down by 7 cents per liter in the month, while diesel went down by between 17 and 23 cents per liter, depending on grade.
The decline was mainly due to lower fuel prices and substitution inflation. Changes in the fuel price often affect the monthly inflation rate. In March, the fuel index softened by 0.4% from February, taking the annual rate from a negative 3.6% to a negative 8.8%. A litre of 95 octane petrol was R22.34 in March, down from R24.45 a year before. The average price for diesel declined to R22.80 from R24.85 over the same period.
The low inflation environment would usually mean better prospects for the Reserve Bank to lower interest rates. However, Standard Bank economist Dr. Elna Mollman says the central bank is concerned with medium-term risks to the inflation outlook stemming from the international factors like the current trade war between the United States and China.
Consumer inflation was significantly lower than expected in March. This was partly owing to a slight downside surprise in food inflation, which increased less than we expected. It was mainly owing to another downside surprise in the big rental category, which is surveyed only quarterly. This is the second consecutive downside surprise in the quarterly rental inflation data, which has been clearly reflective of ongoing weakness in the residential rental market. The data generally reflects very benign inflation pressure, and this vindicates the Reserve Bank's interest rate cuts so far. But unfortunately, this won't necessarily remove the Reserve Bank's concerns about future inflation risks from global tariff developments in particular.
Economists expect inflation to continue a downward trajectory in April before resuming an upward trend in May due to base effects. Inflation is expected to average below the midpoint of the Reserve Bank's target range at 4% this year. Gloria Sefakomosi, SABC.
All right, there you had it. Now we can go into a very short commercial break, and once we return, we'll take you through the local updates. Do not go away.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Onthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So not fraud, it's a scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
the views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers.
All right, the time is 36 minutes in the hour of 6 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. Now, to start off locally, to share with you a local news or economic news, is that the Prime Minister, Elia Nguale, read this speech on behalf of President Ntumi Ndaitwa at the conference of official opening of 7th edition of the Namibia International Energy Conference that was yesterday. Now, President highlighted that this year's theme is leading the way in the becoming an energy hub with in-country value reflects our nation resolve to shape our future with purpose and, of course, quality. The Namibian's energy journey has been shaped by foresight and deliberate actions. Now, long before the recent discovery, the government actively promoted the country's potential in oil and gas and renewable energy, laying a strong foundation for long-term growth. Now, the establishment of a profound state-owned enterprise is one that exemplify such vision of a strategic investment in human capital to ensure that Namibians will be equipped to lead when the opportunity arrives. We might take a listen further on this subject.
Is a critical part of that mission, not only as a catalyst for economic growth, but also as a pillar of our broader vision to position Namibia as a sustainable and forward-looking energy hub. As we continue to reimagine a resource-rich Namibia, one that delivers lasting value and broad-based prosperity, our ambition is now matched by clear direction and practical action. This journey is rooted in our national development priorities and speaks directly to the transformation we seek, one defined by opportunity, equity, and long-term impact. As we gather to chart a course for our energy future, let us be guided by the principles of integrity, accountability, inclusivity, and national pride, which I committed to upon assuming office as the fifth president. Director of Ceremonies, distinguished invited guests, dear esteemed participants, it is a great honor to welcome you to a platform that is not only proudly Namibian, but also firmly continental in its reach and impact. This year's theme, Leading the Way, Becoming an Energy Hub with an In-Country Value, reflects our national resolve to shape our future with purpose and clarity. Namibia's energy journey has been shaped by foresight and deliberate action. Long before the recent discoveries, the government actively promoted the country's potential in oil, gas, and renewable energy, laying a strong foundation for long-term growth. The establishment of Petro Fund as a state-owned enterprise is one that exemplifies such a vision, namely of strategic investment in human capital to ensure that Namibians will be equipped to lead when opportunity arrives. Today, those early efforts are bearing fruit. As the sector evolves and momentum builds toward a new chapter of energy-led transformation for Namibia and the continent, Africa. As most of us know, Africa is home to substantial oil, gas, and renewable energy reserves. This potential is key in attaining the aspirations of our Agenda 2063 and achieving the Africa we want, a global powerhouse of the future. This transformation of Africa's economy will be done through tapping into and developing our natural resources sustainably and responsibly. Recent studies show that Africa is estimated to have contributed about 8% to the global oil supply in 2004 and 2005, as both the global and African supply are expected to grow gradually this year. This outlook suggests Africa could increase its oil production from about 6.5 million barrels per day, which is current, to almost 7 million barrels per day by the end of 2025. And Namibia is committed to being at the heart of this development. Namibia has recently experienced oil and gas discoveries, as you have heard, particularly in the Orange Basin offshore. Without a doubt, the government's wish is to move from discovery to actual production without much delay, but with responsibility. Namibia.
All right, there she further also noted that the approach to managing natural resources is collaborative. Government, industry, investors and communities must work together. Now that what the president said. Now the model we champion delivers both long-term value to the Namibian people and commercial returns, and this is the journey we must work together, build on trust and mutual benefit and transparency. That what also the president also said, and then she also added that the welcome investment, not just capital or the welcome investment, but not also just capital, but partnerships that align with the value and the vision. Now we seek partners who invest in skills, infrastructure and knowledge transfer, and who remain committed to Namibia's long-term development goals, and the partnership we form today must deliver a lasting legacy of opportunity for a generation to come. That what the president added. We might take a listen to him to what she have to say further.
The oil and gas sector has developed gradually and steadily. We call on all our partners to work with us in a manner that reflects our shared commitment to responsible and sustainable progress. This next step will unlock the revenues needed to invest in infrastructure, diversify our economy, strengthen public services, and uplift our people. Through a well-paced approach, we will ensure our natural resources create long-term opportunities and national progress. We know the road ahead requires collaboration, technical capability, and strong governance. And Namibia is ready. As we grow our national capacity, we will do so in partnership with those who share our vision for sustainable growth and shared value. Director of Ceremonies, distinguished invited guests, our approach to managing natural resources is collaborative. Government, industry, investors, and communities must work together. The model we champion delivers both long-term value to the Namibian people and commercial returns. This is a journey we must work together, build on trust, mutual benefit, and transparency. We welcome investment, not just capital, but partnership that align with our values and vision. We seek partners to invest skills, infrastructure, and knowledge transfer, and who remain committed to Namibia's long-term development goals. The partnership we form today must deliver a lasting legacy of opportunity for generations to come. Local content and beneficiation remains central to our strategy for economic growth, for inclusive growth. Our approach is practical, faced, and focused on long-term impact. We recognize that each stage of the energy value chain, from exploration to production, presents different opportunities and requires different levels of participation. Our goal is to enable meaningful Namibian involvement by building skills, supporting local businesses, and fostering an environment where talent and enterprise can thrive. Just as important, local content also includes value addition such as developing downstream capacity and infrastructure like refinery and promoting ownership and meaningful participation of local companies in the sector. As our national
All right, there you had it. Now the time is 46 minutes in the hour of 6 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. And of course, to move on to the next item is that in celebration of Autism Month, learners and staff at Elua Special School in the Oshana region took to the streets yesterday in a vibrant awareness march aimed at showing that individuals with autism are capable of making meaningful contribution to the society. Now, the event also marked the inauguration of the new school garden, where learners participated in planting over 200 seedlings. Now, the seedlings ranging from mangoes, guavas, pawpaw, lemons, and other fruit trees were also generously donated by the local farmers and the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform. Now, to listen further on that, we spoke or we engaged the school principal yesterday. That was Aloide Shipo. Pianu, we might take a listen to this discussion. Yes, very good morning to you, Eagle FM listeners. And of course, this is Early Morning Scoop, a show that is dedicated to you, just to speak about the economic update, to share with you, the policy update, the trade, the entrepreneurship. And of course, now here today, we are in the Elua Special School in the Ongwediva Oshana region, whereby they were busy in their newly inaugurated garden, whereby local farmers donated about 200 or more than 200 seedlings. And of course, they also donated seeds for different vegetables, just also to keep the garden lively. And of course, apart from that, one of the farmer or poultry farmer also donated or pledged to give at least 50 chickens, at least for the school to start with the poultry farm. Right now, we are joined by the school principal of the Elua Special School in the Oshana region, that is Madam Loide Shipopchen. A very good morning to you, Mayor Loide, and welcome to the Elements Cube.
Good morning, Eagle FM listeners.
Thank you so much. Yes, Mayor Loide, there are local farmers that just donated about or more than 200 seedlings. And now, looking at this donation, what do you feel as a school principal? And of course, what do you say about the notion only now within our society that are saying that impaired kids cannot do that much? What do you say about this misconception?
Yeah, thank you so much. Let me first maybe just explain who are we in Elua. Elua Resource School is a center which is catering or hosting three different schools. The one that now, where we are now, it's for intellectual impaired learners. Others are for hearing and visual impaired. Now, looking at the exercise of the day, which is seedling planting and the inauguration of our school garden, this is a very innovative way of, or let's say we made this for learners to learn through playing and observation, whereby now we allow them to look at how people are planting trees and how do we have to prepare the soil for planting. This is another way. Remember, this is April, and April we are talking about autism. It's one of the impairment, the intellectual impairment. So we are trying to create awareness in our society that though we are impaired, it does not mean that we are unable to do anything. We are able to do the little that we can within our ability scope. So with that, the trees, they are not just here for shade or for decorative purpose, but it's there for the purpose of this learner to learn how to come up with food from the ground to the shop or to the kitchen. They are, we really appreciate the stakeholders who came through, because these are not just local. When you, people, sometimes when you talk of local farmers, they expect people from within Oshakati and Ongwejiva. Here we are talking about farmers who donated as far as from Windhoek, Okongo, Ruakana, and as far as Opuo. So you can really see that out there are people who are willing to help. It's just a matter of crying to the nation, and then the nation will respond accordingly. So with that, I would like to say this is something which is amazing, and nothing much that I can say other than saying thank you, and may the Lord bless whoever extend his or her hand. And the other impressive thing that we have observed today, the farmers did not just give, they came, and then they helped us also to plant these seedlings. Unlike in some exercise whereby a person will say, get, and then the person will face the other side. With them, they made sure that they come, and they see to it that everything is in the ground as we are talking now. Mm-hmm. And that's one part that really showed me that these people have, they listen from their heart, not just with their ears. The reason why we are called special, we are unique. What I'm trying to say here is definitely this garden will achieve its objectives. With the help of these learners, looking at how they do, especially learners, or let's say our intellectual impaired learners, most of them, they like working with their hands. Unlike in the mainstream, whereby we expect learners to know the content, to memorize the content, with these kids, you have to give them practical work. So now, let me just go back to what I highlighted earlier, that this initiative, it came at the right time, because we are busy preparing for next year. Come 2026, we want to introduce the subject of agriculture as a basic skill. So now, if we are to look at these kids, we are already preparing them. We are already activating that curiosity of how are things done in them, I mean, in the garden. So even though they are impaired, they are capable of looking after the plants. Mm. They are capable of looking after their properties. Mm. That's why, if I may tell you, dear listeners, these kids are staying in the hostel. Mm-hmm. And most of them, they are taking care of themselves. Other than the caretakers that we have, not every time that one should be after them. What does it mean? It means that they are able, they are capable. But the only difference is that they are not like others. They are special, so they have limited skills or abilities, mm-hmm. but the little that they can, they try to use it to the maximum. Mm-hmm. So with the garden, I'm not worried.
Yes, and of course, within the ceremony itself, I mean, we have had that also, one of the pottery farmers, oh, that is now Mr. Unonas, donated also, or the priest, to give at least 50 chickens to this special school. I mean, looking at 50 chickens also, and this is the pottery family we're talking about, what do you say as a school principal, and of course looking at also this impaired kid or this special kid also, how do they also contribute to the economic of the country, if also the listeners could also hear that from you?
The part of the chicken, it's really something that it gave me goosebumps, if I may say so. Not every person will tell you that here are the 50 chickens. We look at the cost of all those things, but this person, it's awesome. I believe the reason why he decided to do that for us is to motivate us to continue developing the skills in these learners. Remember, this today, these are kids. We are referring to this learner as kids. Tomorrow they will not be kids. They are going to be adults. They are going to own houses and families. What we are trying to do here, we are trying to, with the chickens, they will also give them a picture of, other than plants, what else one can do
to have an income and also to be independent. These kids in the society, mostly they are just considered as reliables. Mm. It's like they depend on, for you, a mother might say, even I cannot even go out because I have an impaired learner. Mm. But if we are giving them these chances of discovering themselves and trying to see what are their hobbies, and it's like we are preparing them. And the chickens, they are not just coming there and then for them to look at how they are hatching eggs and how the meat of the chicken is prepared and how things are done. They will also learn in such a way that we might integrate it into our lessons also. Let's say it's mathematics. We have to take our kids to the chicken house and then they'll start collecting eggs, and then at the end we might ask them, can you count for us those eggs? What are we doing? We are developing their numerical skills. If we are to say now we have collected the 10 boxes of eggs, let's go and sell them. What are we doing? Are we not developing business skills in them? And then if we are to say now, apart from the 10 eggs that we are going to sell, some we have to boil them in our kitchen for breakfast. What are we doing? Are we not going to give them a picture of that? The food that we are getting in the shop, somebody prepare them before. Like, you have to look after your plants and your animals for you to be able to feed yourself. Mm. Let's plant. Let's take care of our animals for us to feed the nation. That's what we are trying to do. Dear parents, dear guardians, children are gift or blessings that we got from the Almighty. So whatever or what kind of a child you get from our Almighty, embrace it. The other thing that we have noticed as teachers, and we would like to take it back to the community or to say the on air, dear parents, let's treat these kids as normal kids wherever it's possible. Train them how to look after their things. Train them to be in public places. Most of the parents, we are even avoiding to take our children, the impaired children, either even to local stores or even to church or to whatever social evening we have or events that we have. Mind you, a child who grew up in a village where various events are hosted, but this child never even attended any event. Now, when are we going to prepare these kids to be in the society? Let's make use of any chance that you have and expose our little ones. At the end of the day, they are going to be part of the community, and they will only be good citizens if they are exposed. So let's try by all means, let them explore where it's not harmful or dangerous to their life. But other than that, they are children and they should be treated as children.
Mm. Thank you so much, Meloide.
Welcome.
All right.
One of the poultry farmer also contributed or rather preached to give 50 chickens to these special children, whereby they are going to also or rather have also to create at least a poultry farm in their school, so that at least in the future they can also able to sell their eggs and all that. But right now we are joined by farmer himself, that's now Mr. Gustav Unona, just to share with us that why did he also get to a point where he want to donate or he want to preach these 50 chickens to this special school? A very good morning to you, sir, and welcome to the Element School.
Very good afternoon to Eagle FM. And thank you for accepting it to be interviewed to the Eagle FM. First of all, today it's an amazing day. To Elua Special School, whereby we have children are busy doing a plantation. There are a lot of plant and seedling taking place over here. But as I'm a poultry farmer, I was so amazed, and then I came up with an initiative that, what if I also happen to give something, something like poultry to this school, so that they can also do agriculture in the section of poultry farming? So they are really appreciate that, and my heart is touched And for sure, I pledge and I want to give this to Elua Special School, to the section of intellectual. This chicken, it could be a startup for this school, so that they can learn how to make poultry. And beside that, because not everyone really is an expert on poultry, so I decided to give a free training to the teacher and to those who are going to take care for this poultry farming, so that they can have skill and knowledge how to take care, how to manage, and how to give remedy to the chicken in order for this chicken farming to grow. Absolutely, that is an ambition. They say that you should start small. I want this school, Elua Special School, so the children to eat their own fruits. And I want also to teach a Namibian child how to be a farmer while they are young. Once they are grown, they already have this mentality of farming. Yes. What I want this poultry farming to grow. Not only to have 50 chicks, but I want them, especially when it comes to next year, they could be able maybe to have three or four sections of farming. They are producing eggs, they are producing chicks, and they are also producing chicken for consumption. I want them to eat their own food. That is my ambition. And I hope so. This is going to be done as soon as possible in this school.
All right. And of course, there's also misconception around us, the society, because impaired kids are not really able to do much of the task. Like, you work here or speak to us. Will this garden prosper? Or what is your take on this?
Thank you, Evgeny, for the next question. And let us take out that myth from our community. These are very, very nice children. Elua Special School is divided into three sections. We have hearing impaired, we have intellectual, and we have visual impaired. And all these children, when we are with them, they are normal children, just like other children. We live together, we love together, we work together, with no doubt, with no fear. So everyone got a challenge in life, but that challenge could not limit someone to work or to reach his target or ambition. So when we are here in the school, we do a lot of tasks with these children before. That's why I have a hope that being given this working of gardening and seedling, and being starting to work with poultry farming, It's a simple work to them. As long as you train them how to work with poultry, as long as you train them how to watering the garden, it could be an impressive and it's enjoyable to them. As you can see already that they already started and they are so happy. It brings also their mind to be fresh and feeling that they are also calculated as a human being like others. Definitely there's no one who abnormal. To us, everything is normal. We don't know even anything. That is just a myth. To us, we are so happy to live in this school. I've been here for 10 years. And I'm very happy to work in this school. That's why I want to work again with them, to do poultry farming with them. I just want to tell all my Namibian people that whoever willing or have a willing to at least donate something, when your heart spoke, do it. Give. This is a small thing. When we are talking about 56 chicken, they are small because this school have about more than 300 children. And our dream is for every children to at least eat eggs per day. So it cannot be done by one person only. some of us, we just create a way so that other will follow. So I want to ask my Namibian people so to start to take part giving whatever they have to our Elua Special School, especially to agriculture. And this will support also a Namibian child so that the Namibian child can also grow in a good manner, in a happy mood, and being with a thought to be a hard work person. So whoever need doing that, we're going to be appreciated. So I also want to say that this year, it's a productive year.
Okay.
We receive the rain. So a lot of farmer, I hope they produce a plantation.
Okay.
They produce food for chicken. So this year, we are going to produce also a lot of chicken so that we can supply everywhere where it's needed, in shop, in any market, so that we can satisfy food to a Namibian nation, so that we can meet our government a halfway.
I mean, you are a poultry farmer. How is the poultry business growing? Is there any maybe challenges that you would also love to share with us, or how is it growing, or also the market? How is the market going also?
The market of poultry is going well.
Okay.
I could say that the demand is higher than the supply.
Okay.
In Namibia, we are not supplying what is expected.
Okay.
I could say so, but this is because the scarcity of food in Namibia, because we don't produce our own food for our chicken. This is also affect the production. So again, we are also having a challenge of selling in shop
or local market,
local market, especially the retailer. We are focusing on retailer, not only locally. We want to sell in shops such Pick and Pay, Woman Broke, ShopRite, and so on. But there are some law that restrict our local farmer for chicken not to sell in those one. And again, there are some chicken that over there, but they are imported. So we are also want to make a competition with those who are importing. I hope the government needed to meet with the farmers, and then the farmer could say they are concerned, so that this solution can, they can come up with a good solution whereby everyone can able to sell wherever he willing to sell, so that they can also amend the law that prohibit the farmers not to sell in retailers, because it's quite challenges. Yeah, that's why we cannot able to sell in bulk at where it's supposed to be sold in bulk. Once you are selling in bulk, you can able to produce also in bulk. I think the government is going to sit, especially in the Minister of Agriculture, in order, our target is just to meet our government halfway. Our target is to limit the import that is coming in. We also want to export our chicken outside. Yes.
Again, I just want to ask just one last question on this garden. I mean, we're standing here, and of course, I see also some plantation already. Like, what is in this garden right now?
Currently, we are having a lot of plant. I can see chilies. I can see bananas. I can see even avocado, they are over here. So it's going to be quite amazed. I think after 2 months, if you happen to come again and visit this site, you are not going to recognize this is the place that you you visited before. Because there are even chili. A lot of chili. There are also even mangoes, we have guavas, and we are also planning also to have some onion and tomato places.
Okay.
I think from the day of tomorrow,
okay,
we are planning. Similarly, the reason why we decide also, or I decided that I should give this chicken farming in this school. As you can see that there is no manure over here.
Okay.
So I want the school, when they are busy
in
their garden, they will not go search manure everywhere.
Okay.
They will take their manure on their own chicken house, rather than being running up and down searching. So the importance of this manure, the manure of chicken, they are best compared to the cattle manure and goat's manure. See, because they did not contain urine, this one contained calcium.
Okay.
That's why a lot of people, they like it. Yes. We're also having some maize.
Okay.
You may find some maize having maybe more than three branches. It's just because of the manure that's being given. Yes, so it's going to be a good garden, and we are quite sure that we are going to eat the fruits of this as soon as possible.
Thank you so much, Mr. Unona.
Thank you so much, Eagle FM.
All right. The time is 11 minutes in the of 7 o'clock. This is early morning scoop. Of course, you heard it from the donor, or whether Mr. Unona, who pledged to give at least 50 tickets to the Elua Special Schools school, so that they can also just start with also poultry farm or dealing with the chicken within the school. Now, to move on to the next item, is that we now farm month into 2025, and many businesses as well as the public and private institutions are struggling to measure their progress and evaluate their action plans. Now, according to the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, and of course, monitoring and evaluation should be conducted quarterly to track progress and of course identify necessary interventions. Now, my colleague spoke with Imsa Kangoya, a governance researcher, and about the importance of monitoring and evaluation in the public and private sectors, as well as the business. We might take a listen to what he has to say on this regard.
Oh, things going well. Thank you. Imsa Kangoya, today we are going to look at monitoring evaluations. So, what is the importance of monitoring and evaluation, government or institutions' plans and strategies?
No, actually, the monitoring and evaluation is a very important activity because it's a systematic process that helps the government agencies and government institutes, even private institutes or any other organizations. So it helps them to track and monitor their project. So it helps them to ensure that, or actually it helps them to ensure that the project or the policies that they have in place, they are going as planned. So in a simple term, I should put it like, so monitoring and evaluation is used to assess the performances and the efficiency of the government policies and the government activities. And it also helps the organization to track the progress of their government projects or policies to help them track if they are attaining their intended goals. And also it helps them to pick up any challenges that are arising throughout the project for them to be able to come up with solutions before the project ends or before the policy is worn out.
What are the challenges that can hinder effective M&E in an institution?
The challenges that can hinder the monitoring and evaluation, firstly, it could be lack of expertise. If you don't have the right people, or let me say, if you don't have people with the right skills to monitor and evaluate projects, then it's going to be a problem for the project or for the policies of whatever programs to be monitored and to be evaluated. Because if someone like, let me say, the capacities to go through the project stages and assess if any goals have been attained, and if it has not been attained, why? If you, that person doesn't like that skills and knowledge to go through every step and perform and check very well what are the challenges, what could be the problems, then it will be pointless for a person to attain the goals of monitoring and evaluation. The other challenges could also be lack of financial resources, because in most cases when monitoring and evaluation is taking place, it requires financial resources, because sometimes or most of the times people would be required to go out and conduct research, to go out and interview or to assess, to go if it's, let me say, it's a government project. So those people need to go out there in the public or wherever the project is taking place and assess what is taking or happening at the ground. So it requires financial resources for people to be able to perform their, or for the official to be able to perform their duties in monitoring and evaluating. The other challenges could also be political interferences. Sometimes you would find that public officials are conducting or they are monitoring a certain project. But in the process there, there could be political interferences, such as directives, perhaps from the cabinet or perhaps from the ministers, that would direct them to do otherwise instead of how they are supposed to carry out their duties, and making sure that they've assessed and they've also gathered all the required information for them to be able to produce final reports on the evaluations.
So are there some difficulties might arise during the evaluation process, or maybe some factors affecting monitoring and evaluation?
In the process during the monitoring and evaluations. Yes, there are, like what I said, mostly if in public projects or policies, there could be political interferences, or sometimes it could be technological barriers, because some of the people may lack the access to digital tools, specifically, or let me say, if it's in rural areas, or perhaps in remote areas, there might be a need for, or there might be a lack of digital tools, for example, like data analytics software, or there may be poor internet connectivities. So that slows the data processing, and it limits the real time of the monitoring and the whole evaluation processes.
So that means the lack of, sometimes it's lack of clear objectives.
Yes, clear objectives, then that could be one of the challenges. But clear objectives, it starts from the beginnings, because the objectives are set at the beginnings of a certain project or a certain policy. So that is also one of the challenges, but it doesn't arise during the monitoring and evaluation process. It actually arises at the beginning, during the implementations of the project. So if a project or any policy is set or is being implemented, but it does not have clear objectives, what the project intends to attain or what the policy intends to attain, then that is already another challenge that is going to affect the monitoring and the evaluation process. Because people, monitors or officials, whoever is monitoring a certain project or policy, the monitors according to the objectives of that project or that policies. So their policies, I mean the objectives and the goals are the guidelines or the guiding tools that will guide the whole monitoring and evaluation process. So that whole systematic process of monitoring and evaluation is basically stands on the objectives. So because its main purpose is to monitor if these objectives are being achieved.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and with the evaluation is to monitor, because the evaluation mostly happens during the last stage of the project, to monitor if the goals have been achieved, the objectives that were set, have they been attained, and all those things.
Okay. So, using various governments such as TPET, Mass Housing, and others that have not materialized as we hoped, can we say they have failed because of ineffective monitoring and evaluations?
Yes, we could say they have failed because of monitoring and evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I believe that most of them failed because of most of them, the objectives were clear, but the implementation process. So perhaps the monitoring was not maybe done in the right way, because if monitoring was done in the right way, they could have picked up before these programs ended, or they could have picked up at an earlier stage that these goals and these objectives are not going to be attained because of this varied reason that we discovered now during the monitoring stage. So basically, I would say yes, but also there are other factors that also affected these programs as to why they did not reach their targeted goals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Technology is improving how things are done. Mm-hmm. Can technological tools and data analysis be used to improve our monitoring and evaluations approaches?
Of course, technology is one of the effective tools that we can use now to improve the monitoring and evaluation process.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's used properly, it would enhance the effectiveness and also the accuracy and the efficiency of this monitoring and evaluation process. So, for instance, by automating data collections, if you collect data through an automated technological system,
mm-hmm.
it could help you save time, because a system could be faster than this more traditional of people carrying out these things. And also it could help the organization to make the data-driven decisions, because sometimes if you capture data using a systems, then it gives you the results by the end. So you don't have to, at the end, make a... let me say, you don't have to make decisions based on your findings, but you make decisions based on the findings of the systems. And also technology, as I also mentioned, that technology, or one of the challenges is lack of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could improve technology, for instance, like communications and internet throughout the country or perhaps in the rural villages, so it would also help to be able to monitor the project and the government policies on time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, thank you so much, Ims Kangoya. Have a blessed day ahead.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
All right, there you had it. The time is 24 minutes in the hour of 7 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. Now, to move on to the one last update of the day is that disappearance of young Kajimi forced family to flee their village in search of healing. Now, 15 years after this, their son vanished within head in Kato near, over the wild head in Kato near 20 mile in Kavango East, Venderino's Hausiku and his family are once again holding on to hope. Now, Hausiku, now 72, still remembers the anguish of April 2010 when his young son, Joseph Kanjimi Hausiku disappeared without a trace. Now, the trauma was so severe that the family abandoned their home and relocated first to Windhoek in 2011 and later to the Ndama informal settlement in Lundu in 2013. You know, in those days, we used to sit at small shabin drinking. That's how Siku recalled. Now, I remember one of my son running toward me, shouting that my boy had gone missing. Now, the place where the children were heading cattle wasn't far from home. I rushed to join the search. We looked for days, but there was no trace for him, he narrated. Now, despite filing a police report and a widespread search, the boy was never found, and the case was declared as missing person file. Hausiku says the weight of the lost has never left him. Now, for the past 15 years, I have lived with a sorrow and grief. I have found solace only in prayers. Now, the pain of losing a child is something no father can truly overcome. That's what he said. Now, but earlier this month, a photo circulating on social media revealed the family's hope. The picture showed a 19 years old boy and reported abandoned in Arandas by an unknown family member. Now, the boy said to have originated from Rundu was now the subject of the search to locate his biological father. Now, on that, Stephen's age and background bore striking a remembrance to the Hausiku family's missing child. Now, without delay, Hausiku's wife and children traveled to Arandas to meet the young man and hear his story. Now, when we met the family who's been living with him, the atmosphere was peaceful. Said Susanna Hausiku, 24 years old, believed to be the missing boy's sister. Now, still, we don't know if he is really our brother. And she said a moment during their meeting stood out. When I spoke to him, he mentioned the memories of a village near a bar and a large tree nearby. So that's exactly where we used to live, but no one told him that. It gave us hope. Now, Hausiku's wife underwent a DNA test to determine if Stephen is indeed their long lost Kanjimi. Now, they are now anxious, waiting the result. Now, I am a believer, whatever the outcome, who will accept it? It is our faith. Now, that's what Hausiku said. Now, meanwhile, on that, the police have launched an investigation into how the boy indeed or ended up in Arandas, working to locate the man alleged to have abandoned him. Now, for now, my only wish is for us to be reunited if he truly is my brother, but if not, let justice also take its course. That was Susanna's word. And of course, the Kanjimi's, not Kanjimi, but then also the boy's sister, that seems to be the sister. Now, that was the last item of the day. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Early Morning Scoop. It was all Early Morning Scoop, and of course, the time is 29 minutes in the hour, 7 o'clock. And I really, really appreciate you, and please keep tuning in to the rest of the program of the day. And of course, the next program is the Unpacking of the Day. Please do not shift away from your app, from your radio. Please just stay tuned. And of course, you can also hear what Daddy Mike has for us today. And of course, do not forget also to follow us on social media pages. Please visit our pages, Eagle FM Namibia, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, as well as WhatsApp channel. Do not forget to subscribe. And of course, just catch up and be or stay informed or based on what we post there, especially in terms of economic news or economic updates. And of course, do not forget to do download our app, Eagle FM app, on your Google Play Store and, of course, your app store. Please do that. Thank you so much. And from me, listening is a good day.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lodritz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear.